It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The city of Baltimore has lifted a 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew in the city imposed nearly a week ago amid civil unrest over the death of Freddie Gray from injuries sustained in police custody. The emergency curfew was put in place after riots took place in West Baltimore a week ago today. The decision to end the restriction comes after Friday's announcement of criminal charges against six officers involved in Gray's arrest by Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. But important questions have been raised in the wake of that announcement, and here to try and answer them is University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris. David, as always, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good to be with you again, Paul.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email at ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. On Friday, David, six officers were charged. We're talking second-degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, and more. How unusual is this?
Well, it's very unusual at all to have indictments of police officers when they're involved in the death of a citizen. That is the exception to the rule. And the particular charges, the seriousness of several of the charges, is another thing that's unusual. We don't always have, even with a death, charges that are as serious as homicide level. So I think that this is a different kind of case and maybe a more serious moment.
And how would you characterize this case against these officers? Does the in this particular case, is it a good case that has been drawn up against them by the Baltimore State's attorney?
Well, that's the thing. You know, we don't really know. What we know is that she feels that she has enough evidence to go forward. And that's the appropriate judgment to be made at this point in things. She needs probable cause to bring charges against the officers. And she needs to have a belief that she could prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. With probable cause, that's not the same amount of evidence you would need to win at trial. So she feels she has enough evidence to go forward. What I think everybody should remember is that we have only heard one side of this so far. We have heard her narrative, and we have not even heard all the details of how the injury happened or what role each person played. So we have a long way to go before we can truly assess how strong a case she has. She believes that she can go forward. I think we ought to wait, suspend judgment, and at least hear from the autopsy report, from the police investigation, those details. And then we will begin to hear from the defendants as well, first in a sort of court of public opinion way, and then in court itself, because I do expect that this will go to trial at least against some of these defendants.
Some say that this is an egregious rush to charge the six officers, that it's being done to placate outraged citizens.
You know, I heard many comments like rush to judgment and so forth. I don't think that it is. I think if you look at the last several cases of police citizen violence that involved a death that we've been talking about in the country over the last 2 months, I'm thinking of Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina, the deputy in Tulsa who killed Eric Harris. And now this, what we are seeing is an increased willingness to go forward once the evidence is there. I think if these things had happened a year ago, often the investigation would take a long, long time. And the decision on whether or not to prosecute, that would take a very long time. I think now that there is a consciousness that there is no chance the public is simply going to get distracted and forget about this. People are demanding action one way or the other. And so when the evidence is there, prosecutors are more willing to go ahead and announce the charges. I don't think this was done specifically or even primarily to placate people. A prosecutor who does that is really playing with fire, because then you got to back it up. You're going to court at some point. You better have the evidence.
What are the homicide charges of a second degree depraved heart murder, which we probably should define?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
this is a phrase that or a term that a lot of people probably are not familiar with. So you have second degree depraved heart murder and B, manslaughter. What are these charges about? And maybe we should start by explaining depraved heart murder, which applies to the driver in this case.
Yes,
who was he's accused of having driven this police vehicle with Freddie Gray exceedingly fast, in a way, allegedly, to attempt to inflict injuries upon Freddie Gray, who was shackled but not secured in the vehicle.
Yes. We don't know all the details of how the injury was supposed to have happened, and I think that's going to be the core of the case, is what was the mechanism of the injury and who's responsible for it. But the charges, depraved heart, second-degree murder, that's old common law language. In the universe of homicide charges, there are different possibilities. One is first-degree murder, one is second-degree murder, then you go to manslaughter, and then maybe negligent homicide. Maryland sets up its homicide charges in that kind of hierarchy. When we get to second-degree murder, not all varieties of second-degree murder require the intent to kill. Depraved heart is one of those varieties that does not require an intentional killing. So when somebody's guilty of depraved heart murder, it is about taking a risk that the person was aware of, and that the risk is an extremely high risk of death or serious injury to another person. So that's
what, like inflicting a beating on someone and you didn't intend to kill them, but a death results from it.
It could be. Yes. Yes. Classic depraved heart killings. Every once in a while, you hear of a death that results when some idiot goes up on a highway overpass with a bowling ball or a big chunk of concrete, and they're dropping these things on cars. All they want to do is smash the car in the window and so forth. But eventually, they kill somebody. Now, they don't intend to kill somebody, but that is so extremely reckless. There's such a high probability of death if the car is hit, that is considered second-degree murder. So no intentional killing, but such a high degree of recklessness that death or serious injury is very probable. Then we get to manslaughter. There are two types of manslaughter. One is sort of losing your temper manslaughter. That's an intentional killing. But this isn't that. This is reckless degree of manslaughter. In other words, another instance of risk-taking, but not the same high degree of risk. Just a high risk, not extreme, just high. So both of the types of homicide charges involved here do not involve intentional killing. They involve degrees of reckless behavior.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Pitt Law Professor David Harris. Let's go to Matt in Bloomfield. Matt, thanks for waiting. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
How are you guys doing? I listen to the show a lot, so I appreciate you guys putting me on.
You're welcome.
My question is for law professor, and it goes pretty much like this. Do you think at any point that the judicial system has a responsibility to hand out judgments that may or may not actually be in line with the actual legal definition of what is against the law or what have you, because they need to address an actual situation where, an example, extreme police brutality and negligence that is happening in such a way that it is somehow avoiding prosecution, as in the case of Freddie Gray being, probably murdered by Baltimore police officers and them escaping prosecution or potentially escaping through careful understanding of the legal system. And I'll take myself off here.
Wait a minute, Matt. Just to clarify here, you're saying that you're speaking to the intentions of the Baltimore police, and if I'm interpreting it correctly, it sounds like you're saying, did the Baltimore police orchestrate this in a way that they calculated what charges they may face as a result of what they were doing?
Well, what I'm saying is, for example, okay, we have an obvious problem that's going on in the United States, and that's police brutality, right? And, at a certain point, unless police officers are going to be held accountable for this in a legal way, criminal way, sent to jail, they're going to find ways to get away with it.
You're saying
repeatedly.
You're saying that they they're thinking they can get away with this, therefore that's why they're doing it?
Well, they can get away with it, and they think that they're right, and they don't really care. And in addition to that, they know the law, and they are surrounded by a group of people that are willing to, you know, sit around and brainstorm these, you know, oh, well, maybe you shot him when he was doing this. Like, yeah, I get it.
Okay, David.
You know, they're all, like, sitting around trying to figure out this scenario that happened, and they find ways that say, well, technically he was, you know,
right,
falling down head first at me.
We get the idea, Matt. Matt, we get the idea. David, okay. David's ready to answer your question. Thank you for clarifying that. Thank you, Matt. Okay, go ahead, David.
I think Matt's question is interesting. What courts can do and what they should do only is to judge the facts of the case before them, to judge based on the evidence. And when I say courts, I mean not only judges but juries too. That's all we can expect courts to do, and they have to operate in the legal environment that they have, the law that is there. If we believe, as Matt's question thinks implies, that in some situations police may, quote, get away with something because of technical aspects of the law or because of something else, the time then is to move to another one of our institutions, not courts, but to move to legislative bodies like city councils or Congress or state legislatures to impose new sets of rules or procedures or accountability mechanisms that can address the problem we perceive is out there going forward. They don't help the initial case because that's for the courts to decide on the evidence. But if we want change in the way police operate, there are ways to do that. We just have to demand it of other institutions.
It's Essential Pittsburgh, and we're talking with Pitt Law Professor David Harris about the news over the weekend that six Baltimore police officers have been charged with a variety of criminal charges in the wake of the death of Freddie Gray and his arrest by Baltimore State, his arrest, and after his arrest, he died in police custody. So questions have come up, charges have been issued, and what happens next is the conversation we're having with David Harris and what all this means. For example, David, does the swift charging in these cases mean that they'll be slam dunks, that the evidence is very strong?
Not necessarily, Paul. And I think many people were surprised by how fast the whole thing went. This is the one thing that people seem to agree on. They were surprised by that. And I'd go back to what I said a few minutes ago, which is, you know, if it was a year ago and not in the post-Ferguson environment, I think we would have seen a much longer, more deliberate process because, frankly, in many cases like this, those in charge of the police investigations or the prosecution cases would take their time just to wait till any public attention is no longer being paid. That's obviously not going to work anymore. We've seen sustained public attention to all of this. So I think the feeling is now, look, if the evidence is there, we're going to charge. That's what the public wants if the evidence is there. So the fact that they charged was surprisingly swift. But it doesn't mean the cases are necessarily a lot stronger. I would just caution everybody to understand that any criminal case against a police officer is going to be very hard for the prosecution to win. Any case, even the strongest cases, for institutional reasons. I mean, you know, a lot of times the prosecutors don't want to charge them, but for reasons that, you know, I think are built into the jury system and built into the culture. People, when they walk into a courtroom as jurors, most people, most of the time, view the police officer as the good guy. And so you're going to have to overcome not just the legal presumption of innocence, but sort of the presumption that this person was doing their job and doing it correctly. So it's not like a regular case, not at all.
Why weren't these cases brought to a grand jury for investigation, for charging, like in Ferguson and New York / Staten Island and other cases?
Yes. They don't have to be. That's the short reason. The right to a grand jury is part of the Bill of Rights, just like the right to counsel or the right against unreasonable searches and seizures. But that particular right has never been applied to the states by the Supreme Court. So some states have a grand jury system. Some states no longer have it at all. In Maryland, the prosecutor can choose between going to a grand jury or simply charging based on the prosecutor's own sworn statement. That's called an information. And that's what the prosecutor here chose to do. She decided to go ahead. She did not need grand jury investigation. She had all the evidence she needed, and there was no point in wading through that whole process.
Let's go to Carrie in Canonsburg. Carrie, you're on with David Harris.
Hi. I had a quick question. I wanted to know if you had any opinions on why the prosecutor may not have chosen to employ felony murder or conspiracy to commit charges in this case, given the number of officers who would have been involved in the incident.
Good question.
That's a great question. You can come to my criminal law class anytime. I don't know about felony murder in this case because that gets somewhat more complicated, probably for reasons that we won't even go into here. But the conspiracy question is very interesting. When you have a large number of people, and six is quite large, engaged in some kind of wrongdoing, and if there is any evidence that might imply the existence of an agreement between them, prosecutors are very happy to charge conspiracy. It gives them certain advantages at trial. It gives them certain advantages under the rules of evidence. In Maryland, the charges can be amended up to the point of verdict. So I would not be surprised if some evidence emerges along the way that there was an agreement or something that implies an agreement that there will be conspiracy charges. It would not surprise me.
There is an email question that came in. Can the onboard computer in the police van provide some information? My understanding, and this is, this is from Richard, who emailed this question. He says, my understanding is that all modern vehicles come with computers that store driving information, including acceleration. Also, this information is not stored indefinitely. If the vehicle is still in use, it will be overwritten with new data. Has anyone taken a look at this information? And I guess the other interesting part of this question, David, is that van still in use? I mean, do they take it out of circulation after something like this happens?
It's a great set of questions, Paul. I don't know if it would still be in use. The fact that a prisoner who was being transported in it later died. He did not die until a week later. He simply had a very serious injury. The officers taking him out of the van and giving him to EMS for transportation to a hospital wouldn't necessarily know just how serious it was, so they might not have any reason to take it out of service themselves. And then you combine that with the fact that in most large police departments, vehicles are not handled by, scheduled by the folks who are just in the patrol uniforms. I'd say it isn't necessarily a sure thing that they would take the vehicle out of service. I don't know if all vehicles are in fact equipped with that kind of onboard computer. I can see why it would be a good idea, but if it gets overwritten, as Richard says, there's a chance there may be no evidence there anyway.
Let's go to John in Pittsburgh. John, you have a question for David Harris.
Yes. I heard my son is studying in Johns Hopkins, and the police officers are out on bail on sums that are pretty modest. Now, and just before the weekend, one of the kids threw a stone and broke a windscreen off a vehicle, and his bail money just for breaking the windscreen was, I understand, $500,000. Why someone who is accused of, say, killing a person, his bail is so modest, and the guy who broke the windscreen, his bail is $500,000?
This is a great question. The original purpose of bail is to make sure that people appear at trial. That's its only purpose. Over the last 30 years, the Supreme Court has allowed in the federal system and in some state systems a change. They've allowed bail to be assessed on whether not only will you show up, but are you a danger to the community? And it might be that the judgment is that the police officers are no danger, but the young man participating in a stone-throwing riot might be. I see the inequity that is in back of your question, too, and I think probably a lot of other people see it. People who are police officers, they're going to have an address. They're going to have lots and lots of people who will vouch for them. There's not going to be an issue with them showing up to court, whereas somebody who might be somewhat more rootless, that might be an issue. But to have that extreme a difference really does tell you something about the court system, not the individuals in front of it.
Let's take one last call from Sheldon in Pittsburgh. Sheldon, you're on with David Harris.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Good. This is Sheldon Williams. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well.
And for folks who don't know, Sheldon has been a guest on our program. He is a former Pittsburgh police officer, now a member of the Citizens Police Review Board. Good to have you with us, Sheldon. Go ahead with your question.
My question for David, who I highly respect in his opinion, also a friend of mine, but as we're talking about the swiftness of bringing these charges, I just want to enter into the conversation that we have evidence of something that had occurred prior to him going into the vehicle. And so that something is, you know, we have an apparent injury, at least that's what it looks like from the video, him being dragged over towards there. There's something that happened. And my question simply is, to the swiftness of it, it's a witness-rich environment. I mean, we have some people who are videotaping, we have people who are there. I think that there should have been more of an investigation to try to see what procedures or what type of handling the officers had in making the arrest to probably bring forward into the investigation, because in determining when the person was injured or what precipitated that, I think it's still out there. So the question being is that if we're going to run right quickly to get these charges, I just think that there should have been some element of investigation that says, okay, what were the procedures done in making and facilitating an arrest that probably could have supported why these charges were coming about or at least been brought into the conversation?
Well, that's a great question, Sheldon. How are you? It's always good to hear your voice.
Yes.
There were some charges that were supported by the actions of arrest. You'll remember that the prosecutor did say that the arrest lacked probable cause, but I have a feeling we will hear more about the procedures of the arrest beyond just that. I noticed some hedging in some of her statements. For instance, she would say not the police officers caused this injury to his spinal cord. She would say he suffered a severe neck injury. This tells me that there are some gaps in the evidence, that she doesn't know everything yet that she'd like to. So I would not at all be surprised, as more witnesses are interviewed and more evidence bubbles to the surface, if we see maybe additional charges that are supported by what you're pointing to, or if we just see that evidence folded into the existing case. Because I just have this feeling there's more out there. She just felt, I have enough probable cause to charge now, and I can continue to investigate. And that's her prerogative. She can do that.
Pitt Law Professor David Harris, we're out of time, but great thanks, as always, for bringing some clarity to these complicated issues.
My pleasure, Paul.
Coming up, a conversation with Nazila Fati, author of The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran, is a book written by our next guest, Nazila Fati. Just 9 years old when the 1979 Iranian Revolution swept the Shah from power, Ms. Fati grew up watching her homeland transform around her. She says, while the revolution took away Iranians' personal liberties, it inadvertently created a robust middle class, one that today longs for more personal freedom and a renewed relationship with the outside world. From 2001 to 2009, she was based in Tehran as the only full-time New York Times correspondent in Iran. She also wrote for Time magazine. Nazila Fati is in Pittsburgh, having spoken over the weekend at the City of Asylum, and she joins me now in our Community Broadcast Center studio. Nazila Fati, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul.
Where do things stand as we speak with Iranian struggle for more personal freedom and a renewed relationship with the outside world?
Well, that's such an interesting question because I think this is a very sensitive time for many Iranians because of the nuclear talks that are going on. There's a lot of hope that finally, after over 10 years, there would be an agreement and at least the economic pressure that has been squeezing Iranian middle class, as you just mentioned, would sort of ease a little bit. And I have compared this time in my previous talks and interviews to what happened right before the war ended, the war with Iraq in 1988. That war dragged out for about 8 years. It was very devastating. And Iranian leaders were quite determined to keep fighting, to let the war continue as long as they could because it had galvanized the nation behind an ideology. And this is what the standoff had done for Iranian leaders. It had sort of galvanized the nation behind the idea that nuclear program is the country's right. And they treated the West as the enemy that wanted to stop Iran from having the nuclear program. So if finally there is a solution to the standoff, this pressure would be lifted from Iranian society, and also economic sanctions would gradually be lifted and allow civil society to flourish again.
I mentioned that you were just 9 years old when the 1979 Iranian Revolution swept the Shah from power, and of course many Americans associate that event with the taking of the hostages at the U.S. Embassy in Iran. What do you remember about the event from the perspective of a young Iranian girl growing up and watching your homeland transform around you?
As you said, I was just nine. I was very young. I was still at school. And for me, it was also, I remember chaos. That's the images that I remember, including images of the hostage taking. I remember them on our TV screen. But that was one of the many images of chaos that I remember. I remember hearing gunshots at night. I remember getting the news of people getting killed, even friends of my parents, parents of my friends.
People getting killed, who and why?
Well, immediately after the victory of the revolution, Khomeini started rounding up anyone that he thought would be a threat. And a lot of these people were not a threat. Many of them had just worked for the government.
For the Shah and were presumably westernized, free-thinking people?
Exactly. I mean, not just even accused of being western-thinking, but for having positions under the Shah. Khomeini felt very vulnerable because he knew the majority of people who were educated or part of the middle class did not support his religious ideology. It was mostly people from the lower classes who supported Khomeini, and so he went after people who had worked for the government, bureaucrats, people who had higher ranks under the Shah. Many of them were executed. Those are the images that I remember.
Kind of that page out of the dictator's playbook that the first thing you do is suppress the dissent and solidify your position of power.
Exactly. It's the same.
How did this change your world, though, personally? And maybe you didn't realize it right away, but I'm sure looking back, you can see how this changed the course of your life for better or worse.
You know, it's funny. I think Islamic Revolution was one of those very few revolutions that changed people's personal lives as much as it changed people's public lives. For me, as a nine-year-old, I couldn't do a lot of things that any other nine-year-old girl would do. We used to have a swimming pool in our housing complex. I was no longer allowed to swim there because, according to the clerics, girls were not allowed to wear bikinis and swim in public pools. Within about a year after the revolution, I had to wear a headscarf. All girls were required to wear headscarves, long, loose coats that covered the shape of the body, quite ugly pants underneath them. And I learned from a very early age that women had to become the walking symbols of the Islamic regime. And it wasn't something that we wanted to do. We hated it.
I imagine it had to be very difficult, especially for a girl who's 9, 10 years old and, you know, is just probably at that time becoming interested in boys, and then your whole mindset is there's a dictate that changes that. You're forced to change, at least outwardly, how you appear. And I'm wondering about the tension that you might have had inside as you railed against that.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. And schools were segregated. Even public buses were segregated. Men and women were not supposed to be in any kind of contact with each other if they were not married or if they were not related. But, you know, I don't know how that happened, but very early on, we learned to separate our lives. We learned that we had a personal life and we had a public life. In public, even as a nine-year-old, I learned to lie. I mean, I remember going to school. I was in third grade the first year I went to school after the revolution. And my mother told me that if anyone asked me at school if my family supported the regime, I had to say yes. And this didn't come to me as a surprise. I mean, this came very naturally. I knew if I wanted to protect myself or my family, I had to lie. So that was the public life. The public sphere where we lied to protect ourselves. But then in private, we did everything. I took off my headscarf. I listened to the music that the regime banned. I swam in our pool secretly. And I think that was the secret that helped a lot of Iranians to survive.
And did it change your ambitions, or did your ambitions stay the same with you maybe having to keep certain dreams and ambitions at bay?
Well, you know, I must say that as a woman, as a young girl growing up under the revolution, I never got a sense that there was nothing I couldn't do. The revolutionaries, even the religious teachers who came to our schools, they never told us there was something we couldn't do. As long as we had the headscarf on, as long as our hair was covered, and we sort of observed the dress code, we could do anything. They encouraged us to study. They encouraged us to become doctors, engineers. That was one of the ambitions of the revolution, to raise an educated population. We could do anything. And I have heard this from many foreigners who go to Iran for the first time. They always tell me how shocked they are to see women everywhere. Women are almost in your face. They've become doctors. They are in high positions of power, in management positions. At 35 years after the revolution has managed to raise education levels among women in ways that I don't think a secular regime would have been able to do.
We're talking with Nazila Fati, who is a former New York Times correspondent in Iran. She also wrote for Time magazine, and she is the author of the book The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran. She spoke over the weekend at the City of Asylum. When did you know that you wanted to be a writer or a journalist?
I was always an avid reader as a child, and I always liked writing. But I got my sort of introduction to Western journalism when I was 18. Ayatollah Khomeini had died, and for the very first time, a big group of Western reporters had come to Iran to cover his funeral. And I was watching the first press conference that a presidential candidate was giving to a big group of local and foreign reporters. And it was very obvious that that candidate was treating foreign reporters in a much different way than local reporters. He was sort of trying to pick them and to send his messages. It was very clear to me that he sensed their power in bridging the gap that existed between Iran and the West back then. So I was sort of quite fascinated by the power that those reporters had working for foreign media. Yeah, but then I was very lucky to become one, to start working with them and finally become a writer for the New York Times.
And let's flash forward now to 2009, when threats from the Iranian government forced you into exile. What happened?
After the elections on June 12th, people were angry, extremely angry. It was very clear that the government had rigged the vote. So within about 24 hours, people started pouring out on the streets quite spontaneously. And it was very clear that the government was quite shocked and wanted to contain the news that was flowing outside the country about the protest. So we received letters very quickly that resident journalists were not allowed to cover the protest. Reporters who were visiting Iran on visa were ordered to leave as soon as their visas expired, and almost everybody's visa was expiring within a few days. So that way they got rid of many reporters who were in the country. Then there were a couple of us, about a dozen of us, who were based there. And they started threatening us, making calls. I received a call from a commander I had met during one of the demonstrations, who told me that my picture had been given to protest to snipers to shoot at me if they saw me on the streets. And I was going out because the protests were the largest I had seen. I think, the most important historic events of the country since the revolution. But then one day when I was driving out of my driveway, I noticed that there were people outside my home, and one of them shouted very clearly, "There she is," as soon as I pulled up on the streets, and they began following me. I got so scared that I went around the block, went home, and I stayed in my house for 3 days until I went to the airport and left the country. I learned later that they had an arrest warrant for me just a day after I had left.
So you might not be sitting here now.
I don't know how long they would have held me. Even at that time, I was not aware of what was happening to people who were arrested. A lot of my colleagues, a lot of my sources, almost all my sources, had already been arrested. Very naively, I thought they were just keeping them and they would let them go. But they were being tortured. None of those people are the same people after their release. What happened to them was quite dreadful.
Can you go back? Do you want to go back to Iran?
Well, Iran is my home. I want to go back. And I hope one day I will be able to go back. But I haven't received any kind of assurance from anyone inside the country that I would be fine if I go back now.
And while it's impossible to predict whether the Islamic Republic will collapse or survive in its current form, what do you think will happen? Where is Iran headed at this point?
Well, you know, it's a fool's job to make predictions, and I'm not very optimistic that in the short run, Iran is going to become a democracy. But in the long term, I'm very optimistic because the current leaders are quite old. They're all in their 70s or late 70s. Their children are by far more moderate than themselves. In fact, during the 2009 demonstrations, many of their children were out on the streets and many of them were arrested. So when you're faced with leaders who haven't been able to raise their own children to be loyal to the ideology that they brought to the country, I don't think they can keep that sort of ideology alive anymore. I think the future would be much more, the future generation would be much more moderate. They are already much more educated and connected to the outside world than their parents. The majority of Iranians have cell phones. A lot of people are connected to the internet. The majority of people have been watching satellite TV since the early 1990s. They are very well aware of the life outside the borders of Iran, and they want to be part of that world. They want to have a country that is accepted by the outside world as well.
My guest has been Nazila Fati. She is author of The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran. She is an accomplished journalist who, as I mentioned, worked for several years for The New York Times. As a correspondent in Iran, she was here over the weekend speaking at the City of Asylum. It's been a pleasure having you in our city and in our studios. Nazila Fati, thank you so much for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Paul, thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, we'll talk with our pop culture contributor Joe Woes about his new nationally syndicated puzzle and cartoon feature, Maze Tunes. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today marks the debut of the nationally syndicated puzzle and cartoon feature Maze Tunes. Its creator is our pop culture contributor, Joe Woese, who joins us now in studio. Joe Woese, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's always great to be here.
So talk about how you came up with this idea. What is Maze Tunes exactly?
So Maze Tunes is a hybrid between a cartoon and a maze. They are illustrated cartoon mazes. So as you're going through the maze, you might encounter a chicken or a wildebeest or a house, and you actually go through that section of the puzzle. So it's a little unique that the illustrations are actually embedded into the maze and fully solvable. You know, I've been drawing these since I was a little kid, since I was about 10 years old.
And so at what point did you say, you know, I think this would be something that would be of interest to kids and adults for that matter, or as they say, kids of all ages around the country and around the world?
Well, it's really a bit of a, like my mazes, sort of a convoluted path. I left the Toonzeum with these goals in mind, that I would become a writer, I would become, you know, a syndicated cartoonist and a lot of different things. And, you know, this was the craziest of all of them, that I would be able to become a syndicated cartoonist. I knew I couldn't do a comic strip. I just don't have the discipline.
Why not?
I don't have the discipline to sit down every day for the rest of my life thinking of something funny, developing the characters. It's a very long, arduous process. The mazes for me are just intuitive. They're a part of my, you know, rather twisted brain. So I you know, wanted to do this, and one night at about 3 a.m., I woke up and said, I'm going to do this right now. Put together a packet of some mazes I had done, whipped up a couple more, and went online to try and find syndicates. And I looked around, and I looked at the big three and creators.
Who are the big three, by the way?
So you have King Features, you have Universal, and you have Creators.
So most of the comics that people see in the comics section, which I happen to read just about every day.
99% are one of those big three.
Okay.
King and Universal accept submissions only through the mail. Creators took them online. I clicked send and immediately regretted it.
Why?
Because I knew the format wasn't right. The packet wasn't right. You know, comic strips are notorious. Syndication is notorious. It takes you 3 months to hear a no. Of the 10,000 submissions that they get between the three of them every year, they might accept only 10 between them. So I knew the odds were so far stacked against me.
But they accepted yours.
They actually gave me a phone call on Monday. I submitted on Saturday night. I got a phone call on Monday saying, we're interested. Hmm. Unheard of. My cartoonist friends are going, you're making it up. This is crazy. It can't happen. And within a week, I had a contract. It was unbelievable.
So I had a, you know, one of the questions I had for you was explain the process of syndication, but it's like 1, 2, 3, go online, find a syndicate, send your stuff. 2 days later, here's your response.
And it was just miraculous. The real process that's supposed to exist is you put together, you develop these characters, you develop your concept, and you put it all together. You come up with this packet. You have to have at least 24 dailies and at least 4 Sundays. You send this out for review. They give you a rejection. If you're lucky, they give you some tips and some pointers. You submit again in a few months. It goes back and forth for up to a year. There are cartoonists who have been doing in this process of trying to get submissions for over a decade. And it's extremely – you'd have better luck becoming an astronaut than you would syndicated cartoonist. And you'd make a lot more too.
I remember there was an old Major League Baseball player named Ron Kittle who was managing guys in the minor leagues thinking they're going to strike it big, make it big and strike it rich someday. And he would use that same analogy. Your chances of going up in the space shuttle are about as good.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
But you've done it. Now, what about the timing of this?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think we've been seeing the funny pages shrink and shrink and shrink. We're seeing newspapers across the country drop their funny pages. But what we're also seeing at the same time is a conversion to games and puzzles. We're seeing a lot of places that are going, hey, you know, handheld games on your phone and so forth are so popular. People love Sudoku. People love playing crosswords. Those things never fade. So by doing something that's a hybrid of a cartoon and game, I'm able to sort of hit two markets. And the syndicate saw that. They said, you know, the LA Times has converted half their funny pages over to games and puzzles. So mine is at home on the funny pages. It's at home in the dailies comics. It's also at home right underneath Sudoku and the crossword puzzle and Jumble, which is one of my favorites.
We're talking with Joe Woese, who is marking the debut of his nationally syndicated puzzle and cartoon feature, Maze Tunes. Joe, who's picked this up so far?
I don't know.
Okay.
I know my first one, and then they sort of keep you a little bit in the dark. Because you got to remember, once you pick up one, you start. For the next 10 years of your life, you are now a syndicated cartoonist.
You have to come up with content.
You have to come up with content, even if it's only one paper. So if they tell you, hey, you've only got one paper off the start, you go, well, that's it. I quit. I'm giving it up. So they keep it a little bit quiet, and you, as you go, they let you know when you've picked up 10, 20. And once you get past that mark of about 20, you go, okay, this is going to be my job. I'm not going to make a lot, but this is my career for the next 10 years. And your goal is to get above 50, but it can take years to get above 50. And then
above
50 papers. And then you're hoping for 100, 200. We don't hope for 1,000 anymore.
Like a comic strip like Peanuts, for example. How many papers is that in?
Thousands. Thousands worldwide. You know, I'm also syndicated, hopefully, worldwide. Each paper is a little bit more to your income. Each paper adds a little bit more to your impact and credibility, too.
So you could become rich.
You could, just as you could in just as you could in radio.
Right. Of course. So as far as the history-making nature of this, who was the last Pittsburgh-based syndicated cartoonist to appear on the funny pages, as they say?
Your last one would have been Jackie Orms. That's going back to the 1940s.
Wow.
With Torchy Brown.
Old Torchy Brown.
Old Torchy Brown.
What was Torchy Brown?
Torchy Brown, Jackie Orms was an African-American woman cartoonist, the first, in fact. And she worked for the Courier. And she created this story of a very, you know, empowered black woman. This is way ahead of her time in the comics. And it got syndicated. But the moment it got syndicated, she decided to move to Chicago. So really, how far back you'd have to go before you find someone who was a syndicated cartoonist on the funny pages, you'd have to go all the way back to Cy Hungerford, the sort of grandfather of Pittsburgh cartooning, who had a comic strip called Snoodles. This is in 1910.
Snoodles?
10.
Okay.
1910.
Any idea what that was about? You probably know.
It was this little boy, surprisingly, you know, sort of along the lines of like a Calvin and Hobbes, this little boy who has these wild imagination. It didn't last long, though.
Calvin Hobbes now mainly seen on the back of people's bumpers these days.
Well, and also still syndicated. You know, that's one of the things that makes it so difficult to get syndicated is these iconic strips, Calvin Hobbes, Peanuts, and, you know, they hang on to that space.
So as you go forward with this, you know, how do you see it developing? You talked about the process of syndication and being picked up by more papers, but you're following in the footsteps of what has been a Pittsburgh tradition based on what you're telling us.
Yeah.
So how do you see yourself making your mark in 30 seconds or less?
You know, number one, I need the public's help. You know, you got to write to your newspaper and say, we want you to carry Maze Tunes, because that's so much important to this, is building a fan base. And that's where I see things going, is just developing things that really help the fans. They can visit mazetunes.com. They can download mazes. I want to get them in the classroom. It's a great educational tool. I want to see seniors using them to help their memory. I want to see this become something that's a phenomenon. It's something that really helps people, too.
It is something that truly appeals to people of all ages.
Yes, it is. I mean, we just had studies saying coloring books are for everyone. Mazes are for everyone, too.
He's the creator of Maze Tunes, and today marks the debut of his nationally syndicated puzzle and cartoon feature, again called Maze Tunes. Our culture contributor, Joe Woese, so proud of you. Congrats. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. You can catch the entire show online at WESA.FM or as a podcast in iTunes. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.